Welcome to the Pac-Man Podcast. Here you will find Dr. Cindy Elliser and Kat McKeever, researchers at Pacific Mammal Research, talking all about marine mammals. We will have a variety of ways to share information with you through discussing research articles and news stories, interviews with other researchers, and more. Join us to learn more about marine mammals and have some fun.
Welcome to the Pac-Man Podcast. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Kat.
And so this week, we promised you we're doing something a little different. We're not going to do a journal review per se, but we're going to be talking about a very hot topic here in the Salish Sea. But it does have connections to things happening in other places as well, especially ones that share borders, right? We're going to be talking about something that's being built in Canada, but will affect us in the US as well. Because of this transboundary ecosystem that we live in. I hope that obviously everybody here in the Salish Sea will learn something new and be able to, you know, do something that they want to do about it. But also that those of you that are not in the Salish Sea can take this and learn from it and hopefully, do better in other places as well. Hopefully. That's the hope at least.
That's the idea.
That's right. We can all learn. I mean, we can all learn from each other, right? There are a lot of these things that we talk about maybe specific to an area, but really happen in other places as well, just in a slightly different fashion or a different species or a different ecosystem, right?
Yeah.
So the thing we're going to be talking about today is, and some people may have heard of this, some people may not have. I think this is one of the kind of bigger points is that I didn't know about this until earlier this year when I started working up at Western Washington. And Kat hadn't heard about it until I told her.
Yep.
And it's flabbergasting, to use an old term, this is not well known here on the U.S. side of the border. So what it is the Roberts Bank Terminal 2 project. It is, I'm going to read from their website what the scope of it is. So a little bit of backstory. Roberts Bank, there's already a Roberts Bank terminal there. It has there's the coal terminal and then there's the shipping container part of Roberts Bank. It's on a little peninsula that sticks out by the estuary of the Fraser River. And what they're wanting to do is add more stuff there, basically. So the Roberts Bank Terminal 2 is a future marine container terminal on Canada's west coast led by the Vancouver Fraser Port Authority that will deliver critical capacity and supply chain resilience. Roberts Bank Terminal 2 involves the construction of a trade-enabling three-berth marine container terminal on new federally owned land built in subtidal waters to minimize environmental effects. Once operational, the terminal will increase container terminal capacity by more than 30% on Canada's west coast, strengthen reliable access to goods Canadians use every day, and play a key role in supporting Canadian exporters who increasingly want to trade with economies around the world. The project has been designed under our public interest federal mandate, leveraging our deep experience building top-tier sustainable infrastructure. In addition, strong collaboration with Indigenous groups has been pivotal in designing comprehensive environmental mitigation and habitat offsetting. The project will be funded by the Port Authority and private investment, not tax dollars. That is something that's specific to Port Authorities. They're not allowed to use tax money to do these kind of things.
Interesting.
So that's what it is. It's basically a huge, massive change to what's there now. So you might be asking, well, what do they have to do to add this giant terminal for cargo ships? It'll be a three berth terminal where they need to widen the causeway. So basically adding land where there is not right now, and expand the tug basin. So to allow the ships to come in, which will fill in an additional 177 hectares of Roberts Bank. So you're basically just removing 177 hectares of ecosystem changing. For those of you who aren't well-versed in the ecosystem terminology, this is an estuary. This is where the Fraser River dumps out into the Salish Sea, so the inland waters of Washington State and Canada. Estuaries are extremely important nursery grounds for many, many, many different species, for the young growing up. It's where they go hide so they don't get eaten, or at least as much. And it's high biodiversity. It's highly productive. It provides a lot to the rest of the inland waters of both Washington State and Canada. And so fundamentally changing that much of that estuary will have profound impacts on the environment. And so what we're going to be taking a look at today is, you know, what's been talked about economically, what's kind of being put under the rug, but also being brought up by a lot of people, the environmental part. And then also talking about the difference in who knows what about what's happening in Canada and the US and vice versa, right? We didn't, in general, the US, I don't think many people know about what's going on. And the reason why this is so wrong is that this terminal that's going to be built is 1 mile away, roughly 1 mile away from the US-Canadian border.
Right. So the fact that people are not typically aware of this is kind of a huge problem. Like this is in our backyard, like basically in our yard. And we're not, like I said, it's not being publicized on the US side really at all.
And we don't have any input, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're not Canadian. So that technically it's Canadian federally owned land. So we don't have a say in what's happening, except that it's going to affect the waters of the United States and all the animals that cross that border without knowing it, because they don't care about those political lines that we draw. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk more about that, but it's a stark reminder of how we're not really working together when we need to be. And there's, like I said, in the beginning, there's lots of places that have borders, whether it's between counties or between states or between provinces or between countries, if you're in Europe, these things happen all the time, and you cannot just say, well, I'm going to do this here and not talk to anybody else that downstream or upstream about how that's going to affect. So they've done impact studies, right? They have to do those for any kind of project. But particularly these large projects, they've done 10 years of impact studies. So this has been in discussion. This is the other thing. It's been in discussion for more than a decade.
Right.
And
which is fascinating.
Now hearing about it, you know, it's like, what? So they have, it's been in 10 years in the making of going through the different processes of doing those impact studies. They expect it to start in 2027 and take 6 years to build. They are adding 2.4 million 20-foot equivalent TEUs. That's the comparison that they use for their how much stuff there is. So 20-foot equivalent containers. So 2.4 million containers, basically, more are going to be coming through that port. So it's going to increase the container terminal capacity for the port by 50% and increases the container terminal capacity for the West Coast by 30%. So this is a significant increase in the amount, in how much stuff is coming through the port, this port.
Yeah.
The important thing to remember is, where are these ships coming from? Well, they're coming from the Pacific. They're going straight through the Juan de Fuca Strait. That's the only way to really get in here with the big ships, which go through U.S. waters. So, and some of those goods are coming to the U.S., right? They're going to go into Canada, and then they're going to, it's all connected. It's not even just about what's being built there, but what that means coming in. So those ships that are coming in, what they're increasing or whatnot, and then noise and all the other things, is not just impacting Canadian animals or oceans. It's both of ours, because the Salish Sea is all connected and they're going to be traveling through US waters to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we have any input? What's going on?
It's interesting.
Yeah, it really is just, it blew my mind, honestly, of how how I think a lot of us think, like, well, the governments or they're doing their things. They know all these things. They're taking care of all these dots and I's and crossing T's and working in that way. But when realistically are not, and it's difficult. I'm not saying it's a super easy thing to do at all. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of reasons why it's difficult that we'll get into a bit, but it's surprising that it's not even being discussed, especially in today's world, where we are talking about the fact that we need to look at this place as a transboundary ecosystem and really work together. I mean, in 1994, there was an agreement between the US and Canada to do that, to work together more on the health of the Salish Sea and do better. And 30 years later, we're basically in the same spot. Not really too much has happened.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing too, you know, obviously we've mentioned the issues that are coming up through this for US citizens and for US waters. This also has a huge impact on the Indigenous peoples in these areas. So that's the other thing that we'll be getting more into in this discussion as well, and how this is impacting the local tribes who live in these regions and their, you know, what is legally their land as well. So that's another huge both social and economic and environmental issue and human rights issue.
Yeah, no, exactly. And we always, I think, you know, tend to see it just in countries, but these are First Nations, these are tribes, and there are differences between what those have, which, whether you're in a Canadian First Nation or a tribal, a tribe here in Washington and the US, there are different rights based on those delineations, because tribes are sovereign nations, but as far as I understand that First Nations are not in Canada. There, it's a different relationship between the Indigenous people and the US or Canadian governments. So that's another layer of what they're able to do to work with or fight against, you know, things that are happening. But it is very much an issue with their being able to do what they have been allowed to do, or should be allowed to do, and, you know, fish in their normal fishing grounds, and that are upheld by the treaties in the US at least. So as Kat said, we'll get a little bit into that, but it is a government, environmental, economic, political, cultural, ecological thing.
Yeah, pretty big deal is what we're saying.
Right. So what's interesting is what I did a little bit more kind of going across different articles, either that are more pro and against, you know, just kind of see what the lay of the land was. And it's interesting. So they did look at a thing that had, they looked at the forecast changes in the shipping industry, so that, you know, okay, ideally things, what's happening now is not going to be the same thing that's happening 7 years from now when this thing is built, or 10 years from now when the thing's built. You know, so what's the forecast looking like, and does this match up with that and all the mitigations that they have in order for this thing to happen, which we'll get into in a second. But I thought this was interesting. They said that the total number of ships won't increase, which I find hard to believe. Just the size of the ships and the distribution of ship calling container terminals at the Port of Vancouver. So basically how many are going there versus somewhere else.
Interesting.
But I was like, really? The ships are just going to get bigger? I don't know if that's necessarily better.
Right. I mean, yeah, it doesn't, just because there's not more volume does not mean that bigger ships are a positive thing. But that, I also find that sort of curious that they're not anticipating more volume of ships moving through, as in terms of like more different ships.
Yeah. Cause I mean, if you're adding 2.4 million container boxes, how is that not coming in on more ships?
I mean, I guess just what they're, you know, they're basically saying, well, it's going to be that many because the ships are bigger. But yeah, that does seem curious.
But then the ships have to be built bigger. Like, is that someone decided that that's what they're doing? And when does that come into effect? It takes time to fill boats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So energy, I thought that was interesting. But it's, so I think the place to start off right now is that, and this is what we read a white paper that was, it's an emerging issues in the emerging issues in the Salish Sea series that is put out by the Salish Sea Institute, that there's a paper about by Derek Moscato, a white paper talking about the differences between the media in relation to this RBT2, which is what the abbreviation for Roberts Bank Terminal 2. The difference between the Canadian and US perspectives and the media and their role in getting the information out to people that need it to make the right decisions. And that one in particular was basically Canada's has a lot more information.
Shockingly.
Right. Which, understandably, because it is a Canadian thing, but again, within this transboundary ecosystem, it's the idea that the the government and them are not really working in that aspect. And maybe the media isn't either, because, well, no, US people aren't going to really care, so they're not going to click on the story, so they're not even going to bother.
Right.
And that's a problem, right? If it's being stopped before you even get an article out there, then nope, then there's no way the information is going to get out. And I think it's the job of the media to do that, to put all those sides out and to, you know, yell those things. But within the realm of like, well, they have to make money and they have, you know, there's the economic part of journalism as well. They need to get paid for what they do, and that it comes from readership and other things like that. So it's an interesting conundrum of wanting to do the right thing or get that information out, but are they restricted based on that kind of thing, the economics of it? So the idea then is that, like, it's so fraught. So we're not getting the information that we need, first of all. And then on top of that, a lot of the information that's being put out there is from the pro side. So it's talking about how great this is for the economy and that, you know, there's demand, right? So there's demand for this global trade. I believe in Derek's article, he talks about the Asian Pacific Highway, basically that's a strong connection between Canada and Asian countries. So they're looking to strengthen that relationship, and that's economic and political and whatnot. But they're not bringing up the environmental impact of it nearly as much as they are the economic. I mean, there definitely are ones that are out there that are doing that, but the overall arcing story, if you look at, I think most of those articles, is like, this is a boon to the economy, and we're making, you know, we've covered the environmental part, we're going to make up for what we're doing, but this will be great for the economy, and it'll be, you know, awesome moving forward, and we need it, and it's necessary, and it's going to create jobs, and it's going to bring money into the economy. But at what price? So there was one that was said supposedly it would support a lot of jobs, 16,000 plus. But at the same time, there's many on the other side that say it's going to be partially automated, if not more fully automated. You're not actually going to create jobs. It's automation.
That's very interesting too, because that is something that I feel like in our society right now, as we're recording this in 2024, that is kind of an emerging issue in and of itself, is just how much is going to become automated when it comes to work and job roles over the next few years. So that's interesting that it gets the potential for 16,000 jobs. But as you say, how many of those actually will be automated? Because as everyone kind of knows, like, that's a lot cheaper to do it as an automated thing, typically, if you can.
So there's a lot of contention, I think, about exactly what that number is, because it's all forecasts, right? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, this is how many we'll do. But what actually happens is very different. And then once it's gone, it's too late. You can't undo it now that you didn't make the 16,000 jobs you were supposed to. Well, as now you're just left with the 3,000 or 5,000, whatever number it is. And so that's not a clear winner as to why. There was also something about the jobs I was going to mention. And now I can't remember what it was, but I will come back to it if I remember. So there's that economic impact of that. Oh, so the other thing is that, and I read this somewhere else, and it wasn't just me coming up with it. I did read it. Someone else brought up the same point. But we've been talking about this a lot in other areas where, you know, it's a thing called like the demographic cliff, where people in general, like the population of the world is, I mean, we're still going up and stuff, but it's not going up as much. And in a lot of places, it's going down. People are having less kids, like, especially even like millennials and beyond, like a lot of them aren't having kids. So there is going to be a point where we have this dip, and that's where automation comes in too. Like, we may need to automate because there's not enough people for the jobs that we have, because there's just not enough as many people. And I mean, general overall, it's a good thing, right? We are overpopulating the planet, so not bad. But there's going to be growing pains of when that happens. So I didn't see anywhere in the articles that I was looking at that they talked about that, except for the one that was saying like, "Hey, nobody's looked at this."
Interesting.
Yeah, if the population is going down, are they saying right now we need more stuff right now? Not realizing or thinking about or ignoring that in 10 years when it's built, it's going to be a completely different landscape. So we're putting like, oh, we need this many more units because there's this many more people right now that need it. In 10 years, now there's, a million people less or whatever that don't need that. So now you've built this huge thing that is costing a massive amount of money for something you didn't.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Again, like you said, with so much of it being forecasting right now, is that actually being considered?
And the idea that we're talking about that we need to buy more locally, like a lot of
That's
the
the part that
environmental.
was really coming up for me too, was just like, this is, I appreciate, like, this is again, right, where like I appreciate that it's very easy to purchase things online or from other countries or whatever. Like I do that as well. However,
Me too.
it does seem interesting to kind of almost contradict the what has been quite a big push here on the West Coast, especially since 2020, to buy local, to support local businesses, to keep your economy within your local region so that they can subsist. So yeah, I also was kind of picking up on that too, where I'm like, this is great and all, but like this is kind of perpetuating the problem that we already have, which is we're outsourcing a lot of our stuff to other countries.
Yeah, and it's like we need, this is the exact opposite of where we should be going in the future. Like we're trying to save the planet so we can save ourselves and everyone, every animal in it. Well, we need to not increase the thing that is breaking things, right? So that's the idea behind I've got the author's name, but We Are All Whalers, where he's saying like we are all responsible for the death of the right whale because we are all wanting those things on the cargo ships and from cross country, and that greatly increased global trade and how connected we are is wonderful, but it has a cost, and that cost is the lives of these animals and the ecosystem that we all depend on. And so not there, I don't, they're not seeing, they're not, and nobody's looking at it through that lens, and it's very frustrating because it's like maybe we should not keep doing this and find other ways around it. I'm not saying it's easy, I don't have the answers, but I don't think this is the one.
Yeah, well, again, it's just, it's interesting to see massive projects like this with pretty long time frames of construction that are effectively simply perpetuating that existing problem. They're not making any real sign of changing that at all. Because it's one, like you said, it's one thing to deal with what we already have right now and the supply chain that we currently have. But if you're adding another level that's basically the same thing on top of that, you're kind of perpetuating that problem, unfortunately. So yeah, it's again, it's interesting where it possibly is a little bit short-sighted in that way.
Absolutely. And I really think it is. There's a lot of people that are talking about, really a bigger issue we're going to have in the next few decades where the population does go down, and we're this that growing pains of how do we shift what we are used to now with the new landscape of how many people are here and what they want to do, and all this stuff. And we've seen that through the pandemic. Like that's shifted a lot, and things are very different in just a few years between that. So it's important to keep that the look at things through that lens as well. And so the and we alluded to this earlier too. The other part of this is the governance issues related to how this goes forward. And so they did those 10 years of impact studies, blah blah blah. And I'll get into what those showed, which are another hip. There's so many things that are contrary to even things they said in their own paper, in this whole project. Like we're just saying, like this is against what we should be doing in the future for reducing how much global stuff we have going on and doing local. But that there the governance issues are extremely complex between two countries and the indigenous nations. Indigenous, the tribal nations and the First Nations and tribal and tribes here in Washington in the US, and their legality, what they have in relation to treaty rights versus not. I know I'm a little bit more, I'm not well versed in all of that, but I do know, in Washington, the treaties, they have the indigenous people have treaty rights that they can fish and eat and get collect food from their traditional foraging grounds, and keep their cultural practices, they have not been, those have not been upheld very well in a lot of cases, and they've had to fight to keep those, or to show that they're not being upheld and then have them upheld. And which is very unfortunate that that's even a thing that has to happen, right? It's in the treaty. They should have that. That's it. That's it. But First Nations, it's different. They don't have those same kind of treaties that, as far as I know. So their relationship and how they can work with the, and how they work with the Canadian government is different than here. And there are there are so many different nations and tribes and just different groupings that are all their own and unique peoples. And so I think what's interesting is that when I read that statement before, it said that, you know, they've worked with Indigenous communities, and there were quite a few that they said, it was like 30 or 40 or something, that said they that have signed off on it. But there's still many others that have not. And so how do you, how do you say, like, well, these people said it was okay, but you guys didn't, well, we're still going to go through with it anyway. Like, why does one have more rights than the other? And I do not know the answers to that or how that works, especially in Canada, but it's not just two nations, it's two, you know, US and Canada, it's all those Indigenous communities. And and how does that work? How do you uphold the rights that they have when some agree and some don't agree? And, you know, what were the things that happened in the conversations that, you know, that some said it was okay or not okay or whatever. Because they're all different groups. And on top of that, they, I don't believe, really have talked to any tribes on the US side.
That was going to be my next question, if you found anything about whether or not they had actually initiated conversation with the tribes on our side at all.
And as far as I know, when I was looking up one, particularly the Lummi Nation, they have not. And they've spoken out and said it would have devastating impacts on the Lummi Nation's ability to revitalize our fisheries and exercise our rights. So in a way, the Canadian government is breaking a treaty, right? But they're not part of that treaty. But they're still affecting our waters, which affect the Lummi's waters, that they have full rights to be able to, again, go to their fishing grounds and forage as they used to and do their cultural practices and all of that. And so what's interesting is that the Lummi Nation is a good example of the Indigenous people's ability to fight for their rights and stop something because it's breaking their treaty rights. So the Cherry Point, I think it was a coal terminal. That was set to be built, and it was going to have huge environmental impacts, and I think it was still going to go through, but the Lummi Nation was like, no, this is you're breaking our the treaty rights, and the courts upheld it, and it wasn't made. The Cherry Point coal terminal was not created. And so that shows the power of those, of how that interaction between the Lummi Nation and the U.S. government, how that can work. And so, I mean, but I don't know how that works between them and Canada, right?
Right. Well, that's what I was just going to say. This is where it's a really good example of how complicated it gets when you impose what are effectively arbitrary borders on ancient traditional lands, where, as you say, and especially when those lands include the ocean, you know, that gets a whole nother level of complicated. And so this is partly why we wanted to talk about this, is because it is such a good example of kind of this melting pot of a lot of different issues that come up with really any sort of transboundary activity, whether it is construction, whether it is a huge port like this, whether it is anything else that would impact people and the environment. That's kind of one of the biggest issues here, is that, like, how does this work between two different countries? And again, you know, like Cindy said a few times here, like, we don't necessarily have the answers to that, but it's important for us all to be aware that this is going to impact you know, at least here in the West Coast, like this specifically will impact us. And then of course, if you're extrapolating this to something where you live, like notice how that's actually going to impact a lot of things that it, on the surface of it may not appear to.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it is complicated. And like, I think what I wanted to talk about this one is because it is, it's a great example of all of the complexities for anything we're talking about in a transboundary ecosystem, mm-hmm. because it encompasses the cultural, the political, the economic, the government, and the ecological. And it's not easy, but it's something, but we should all be aware of it. As Kat said, like, mm-hmm. that's the first step. You have to know that it's happening in order to talk about it. And maybe we can, you know, put up a stink, and maybe that will have some kind of impact on the future of this project. But it won't happen unless people know that and know the repercussions of it and are not just told one side of the story. Oh, it's a great economic mm-hmm. impact. It's great. Well, what is that? There's always costs. And what are those costs? Mm-hmm. So with that, that's a great segue for talking about what the costs are, but we will take a short break before that. And then we'll get back to it right after a few short minutes or seconds, however long you want to stay away.
Hello, listeners. This is Cindy, the research director at Pacific Mammal Research, and I wanted to take just a minute to thank you for listening and supporting our work. And I wanted to see maybe if you wanted to learn a little bit more about the background of what we do and what we see in the field and other kind of cool information that you can get by subscribing to the podcast for only $5 a month. You can get ad-free episodes as well as these mini episodes where we discuss the things we've seen in the field, the stuff we've gone to with workshops, and other little interesting tidbits of information for our subscribers only. This is a great way to help support PacMam, who we are a very small nonprofit, so every dollar helps us continue the work that we do and provide the information and the fun podcast that we have that hopefully you guys are enjoying. So if you can, think about it, subscribe to the podcast, and help support our work, and we hope you enjoy.
All right, and we are back. So now to get back to those impacts. So now we're getting to the more ecological side, which is what we have a bit more knowledge in. Still, maybe not answers, but more direct knowledge of what the impacts will be on the ecosystem versus the more political nature of things. So what's happened now is that it has to go through a bunch of different places to get permitted to say it's okay. So because of there's in Canada, there are provinces instead of like states, and there's, you know, different regions within there that have a slightly different structure than we have in the US. But the province of BC had to give a certificate that said it's okay to do it because technically it's on BC land, or BC, it's in British Columbia. But what's interesting is that the most recent thing is that the BC granted the certificate saying the federal government is allowed to build there. Their reasoning is that it is on federal lands under federal jurisdiction. So the decision to not issue a BC certificate could not prohibit the project from going forward. Which, fine, but isn't there something in the point of like, hey, we're opposed to this, even if you're going to do it?
Mm-hmm. Right. You'd think that they would want to at least put forth what their feelings were about it.
Yeah. I mean, and maybe they still wanted it and that's just their thing, but like, it sounds maybe like, maybe they have some things against it, but they're like, "Man, it's going to go through anyway, so we might as well just give it to them."
Mm-hmm.
And that to me seems like a bad way of doing business. It seems like you should still at least stay in protest if you really don't think something's mm-hmm. happened, even if it is likely going to happen because of those differences in governance bodies. It's still important, and that could lead to other things. It's not just you by yourself, like them saying that and then somebody else saying it. And that I think sometimes things like that can help change the direction,
mm-hmm.
at least.
Or at least raise some red flags, you exactly. know, if nothing else, at least raise some red flags, perhaps that things get a little bit more investigated and additional information is uncovered, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so there's still some other permit stuff that they have to go through. This is still, that's why it's not going to be starting until 2027, you know, it's 3 years from now. They have to go through these other permitting things. But I wanted to address the environmental part where there are They did that environmental impact assessment. That was that 10-year study of different things. Important point to remember before we get into it, that the Fraser River is huge to the Salish Sea. And again, that's another thing we don't really think about down here in the U.S., how important the Fraser River is, because the Fraser River is in British Columbia. So, you know, we don't think about it. But 50% of the freshwater that comes into the Salish Sea, part of which makes it so productive and wonderful, comes from the Fraser River. A large amount of sediment that comes through and gets shifted around through the Salish Sea, which is all connected, comes from the Fraser River. A majority of the salmon that we just learned about this at a conference on Saturday, the majority of, or a lot of the Chinook salmon that the southern resident killer whales eat come from the Fraser River stock. The Fraser River is a huge component of the entire Salish Sea ecosystem, and the fact that one government is allowed to change that so drastically and have large impacts is really not acceptable. Like, that shouldn't be able to happen. We should all have a say in what's changing something so important to this entire ecosystem. So in that assessment, though, they did say, yeah, it's going to cause some environmental harm. So they at least weren't like completely blind to what they're doing. So in that, they saw that there would be a lot. There's 370 legally binding conditions in the document to address the environmental concerns. The BC certificate added an additional 16, I believe, and that includes 100 measures to protect wildlife. Things like protection of fish habitat, creating routes to allow aquatic wildlife to navigate through the area, noise monitoring so that no net new noise would come through that could affect the southern residents. But that leads to another question, isn't it already too loud? Or is it already too loud for them? So great, which, we're not adding anymore, but we're still not fixing.
Right, and what we've found with the noise studies that we've done so far in the Salish Sea region is that one of the biggest threats in terms of noise comes from this consistent shipping traffic. It's from the large tankers.
The big ones.
And the consistency with which those traffic this region that actually has potentially the biggest potential to impact the southern residents and any other orca in the region. Obviously the southern residents, if you're familiar with the area, are federally protected species, so federally endangered. Mm-hmm. So that's why we're talking about them a little more specifically, but this has the power to impact any marine species in this region. And we know already from previous studies that this is the type of traffic that actually causes the most harm.
Yeah, and I think they said if they quieted, I think it was the top 5% or the top 15% of the vote. I think somewhere between 5 to 15%. We quieted those top ones, we could reduce the noise level by 50% in the Salish Sea. Mm-hmm. Like, it's something astronomical. We get a small number of big ships quieter, it would be huge. But this is doing the exact opposite. Because they're going to get bigger. Making bigger ships, they're going to need a bigger boat. Sorry, I had to do it. So the assessment found, so this is the stuff that really got my goat when I read it. And I was like, you're literally saying all this and then saying, nope, but it's going to be okay. The assessment found, quote, would result in numerous adverse residual and cumulative effects to wetlands, Dungeness crab, juvenile Chinook, and southern resident killer whales. The significant adverse and cumulative effects is the thing, right? So it's really hard to monitor and to understand exactly what cumulative effects are going to be and have been, right? We've already misidentified that in other aspects of ecosystem. But adverse effect appeared 278 times in the document.
Wow.
but they're like, it's okay. We have all of those 370 legally binding conditions that'll make all that okay. Right? That's going to happen, but we're going to do this to fix it. And mitigation is great, but it's not the same as preventing it from the first place. So this is another great example. So they're going to, they're offsetting, right? That's the term of like, well, we're going to do this, but we're going to do this, right? So it's like, well, we're going to put this much carbon in the air, but we're going to build trees. We're going to plant trees over here, and that's going to make up for it. Or we're going to buy carbon from somebody else. That's all this offsetting. I'll do something here and then do something else over there to mitigate, to offset it. Offset appears 261 times in the document. And they are proposing to build 86 hectares of ecosystem, which on its own, so you'd be like, that sounds great. They're building ecosystem, which again, also though, are we good at building ecosystems, or is maybe
Mother? I was just going to say, I'm like, that's kind of an interesting turn of phrase as it is, but moving on.
Right. Like, yeah, we know better than Mother Nature. It's fine. We know how that goes. Great. And other times, other places. And they're commenting like, hey, this is three times the amount that was initially proposed. So they were only going to do like, 28 hectares, and now they're doing 86. So don't they look good? But they don't state that that is less than half the area that is now slated for destruction. Because they're going to destroy 177 acres, hectares, but they're only going to build back 86.
Yeah.
But,
and I would also say, with the whole tree planting thing as an offset to, putting more carbon into the environment, those trees take time to grow. You're not replacing what you take away. Yep. And if those trees manage to survive for the next 50 to 100 years, yeah, maybe you might have finally offset your damage. But that is something where it sounds really good on paper, but the actual process of it working, it's not an immediate return, and it's not as effective of a return, because we tend to also plant trees in such a way that it's not conducive for natural growth of the environment and the ecosystem.
Right, because we're not Mother Nature.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, it's not the same. You're not putting in a mature estuary back.
Correct.
You're like, yeah. Oh, well, that's what it looks like. There you go. That's fine now. And so on your point, offsetting is notoriously unreliable method of ecological atonement, which I like that phrase, right? We're trying to ecologically atone for what we're doing. None of the offsets that they're going to build will be in the delta itself, where the estuary is, but rather they're going to be upstream. So they're like, well, we're going to destroy this part, but we'll give you some more up here. But all the fish have to get through the estuary. It's still a bottleneck.
Right, I was going to say, yeah, it doesn't really solve the problem.
No, you're still putting this giant barrier there and then being like, well, if you can get to the other side, it's going to be great.
Interesting.
And, it's a similar analogy to what has been done to indigenous peoples for a long time, where they're like, well, okay, we're going to take all your land, but we'll give you this land over here. And sometimes it's not even near where they had lived for millennia. And they can't do the same things that they did there. And same thing with the animals. They can't do the same things if you're shifting. And the animals don't understand this. They don't understand construction and building. So it's just like, well, all of a sudden there's a thing here. Maybe some of them can figure out how to get around and to do with the new environment. But that takes time, just as Kat said. That takes time. And some of the species are not going to make it. Like, some of them are going to be able to evolve and adapt to the change of the environment. But it's the same thing as climate change, where things are so happening so quickly, that's the problem. Many animals can adapt to changing environments and changing things and changing climate, but not this quickly.
And the other thing is also, bear in mind, like, this is what, potential of 10 years of construction?
Yeah.
They're anticipating? Yeah. So this is not even talking about the end impact of once it has become a changed environment. Also, bear in mind, you'll have 10 years for these animals to live in a construction site.
Right.
So it's a pretty massive ecological impact that, as Cindy said, they've obviously assessed it to some degree, but their solutions are somewhat interesting given the breadth of the impact that they'll actually have with this.
Right. And then looking at it historically, again, looking at this from where we're starting from, we're like, oh, well, this is the shifting baselines, right? Oh, well, this is what the environment is now. So this is what we're, how we're changing, whatever we're changing, we're relating it to where we are now. But you're not looking at it cumulatively past and future. They're ignoring the fact that 85% of the Lower Fraser has already been obliterated by human infrastructure. Right, the Fraser estuary looks nothing like it did a few hundred years ago, and so we're like, oh, we're only going to take 30% off, or whatever number you want to say. So we're going at 100%. We're going down to only 70%. That's still pretty good. Well, no, we're already at 15%, and now you're taking 30%. Now we're at negative 15%.
Right.
You have
Exactly.
to
That
take that.
threshold point is way lower than what they are assessing it at, unfortunately.
Exactly. And so it's like a death by a thousand paper cuts. At some point, it's just gonna die. And the Fraser estuary is and the Fraser River is so important. It's just not something that we can, and I'm not saying flippantly that they haven't thought about it at all. Obviously, they've been doing 10 years of studies and stuff like that. So they have been doing work. I'm not saying anything against that, but it's still not taking the long-term ideas in here of the sustainability of us on this planet, of how long we can keep this up. And so there are so that I maybe this is a maybe this is a good place to somewhat kind of wrap it up. Was a statement by Justin Trudeau that I saw at the Prime Minister of Canada that I saw in one of the articles. And he said at a UN biodiversity conference, nature is under threat. In fact, it's under attack. But you said that, and now you're approving the Roberts Bank Terminal 2.
And this is the challenge that we all face in navigating under governmental structures, truthfully. Like this is the challenge, is getting people to, okay, so he's seeing that there's a problem, he's acknowledging that there is a
That's
massive
great.
issue. That's fantastic. What does that mean in terms of real action for those people in government?
Exactly. And so
Yeah.
there was something else here that relates to that now that I had forgotten. So Peter Ross was who's a senior scientist at the Raincoast Conservation Foundation, which do a lot of work in conservation and trying to have things like this not happen. But his quote is, it signals yet again that another level of government is not out there to protect our natural resources, to protect southern resident killer whales that are deemed to be endangered under the Species at Risk Act, which is SARA, which is basically our Endangered Species Act. It's their version of that, or ours is our version of theirs. And then it's another signal that salmon and fish habitat and indigenous food security are secondary to very conservative oriented economic products. And I think that sums it up really well, right? It's this idea that that's what's really at fighting here is the economic part and the environmental part. And they both have, there's both valid arguments on, that we do need jobs and humans need to subsist and we do like things the way we have them, in what we're used to our the way we're used to living. But at what point do we need to adjust that and to change it? How can we do that on a grand scale? And how do we have the ability as a species, human species, to look at something and go, right, well, I want that, but not at that cost?
Correct.
Because
Yeah.
this is a huge cost that will have repercussions we can't fix. Like the amount of damage that this could cause, and again, it's future, I don't know, but the amount that it could cause to the entire ecosystem of the Salish Sea, even if it's not that itself, but it adds to all the other things that we're doing, could end up in collapsing the ecosystem. I mean, not to be too bold about it, but it's kind of true. So how do we, and again, you have to balance, like Kat was saying, you have to balance government and the economics and the politics and the culture and the environmental. There has to be a way that we can move forward in a more connected way. And the first step of that is discussing it, is talking about it, and having everybody understand what's at stake. And have both sides. Like, tell everybody what the economic benefits is, or why you're thinking that way, or why you think that we need to have this many more container ships based on how many people are being born and, and the needs and stuff like that. But then also what it's gonna mean. The Pacific, the it's running straight through the Pacific bird, like the oh shoot, I forgot what it's called. It's the Pacific Bird Highway. It's a huge thing right there, and it's going right through there. It the oh, the flyway. It's so there's huge amounts of birds that use that area as oh, and many of those are endangered. How do we balance that is really the question that we kind of wanted to bring up with this as a prime example of the complexities that we've been talking about. How do we dance around and deal with all of those various things in a respectful way between cultures and governments and the people in a way that will benefit as many as possible, but also benefit the environment, because without the environment, we will die. Like I think we've become a little bit, you know, like, oh, just go to the store and get food. Well, where does that food come from? Like, we really become disconnected to where we get the supplies that we have. Even our phones, where does all that stuff from the phones come from? Well, it's all, you know, a lot of it's naturally sourced. So remembering that, I think, is really important. And that we need this ecosystem, even if you don't care about the ecosystem itself or the animals at all, be selfish. Like Kat and I were just talking about this the other night. If we want to survive, the environment has to survive. And this is going to cause some issues.
Yeah. And I think, again, you know, it's important to be considering these things from not just the perspective of our immediacy, but also the generations to come. That's also something that we have become very disconnected from, especially in Western cultures. We don't tend to think about future generations anymore. It's a very immediate profit or loss. And that is something that also needs to change. We have to start thinking beyond ourselves. And for the longevity of, as Cindy said, not just the ecosystem, but also our families and our children and our loved ones moving forward, we have to start doing better with putting in the time and effort now to take steps to raise our own awareness, to educate ourselves on what these issues are, and start taking action where we can, in order to do better for the future.
Yeah, because us hanging around right now, we probably won't be here to see if the ecosystem collapsed, if we continue on the path that we're going. Most of us that are, you know, midlife right now, we'll probably won't be around to see when it collapses, because it does take time. But your kids will, or your grandkids will. And is that the kind of legacy you want to leave?
Mm-hmm.
Or the world you want to leave them?
Yeah.
I certainly don't. So on that, with a little ray of hope, there are conservation groups that are legally challenging the federal decision to approve it. That many of them are Indigenous nations, the Musqueam, the Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh territories in Vancouver, along with the David Suzuki Foundation, the Georgia Strait Alliance, Rain Coast Conservation Foundation, and the Wilderness Committee, represented by EcoJustice, have filed an application for a judicial review in the federal court, challenging the federal government's decision to approve the Roberts Bank Terminal. A lot of them are going on the basis of, you're not upholding SARA, you're not upholding the Species at Risk Act. You say you have to do these things for these endangered animals, and this is the exact opposite of that. I believe the Lummi Nation is also looking for, you know, as to go into legally and try to fight it. So there are a lot of people that are working to try to prevent this from happening. And so I think what we'll end here is just with the idea that you can help with that, right? Go look at if you feel strongly about it. First of all, tell people about it, because most people here on the US side don't know. Talk about it. These are the kind of things we all need to be talking about to make the best decisions and most informed decisions that we can. And check out those different groups and see if there's something you can do to help, whether it's donation or spreading word or, you know, whatever. But there are people out there that are fighting for the environment. And that's important, right? We have to have hope that we can change our ways, because we need to.
Yeah. It starts with us. It starts with everyone as an individual. So
exactly.
Yeah.
So with that, we will leave you empowered to move forward and do things in your life and however you want to interact with the information that we've given you. But it does start with us. So we hope that this has given you information to do that. And please share it with others if you can. With that, we will see you next time for a marine mammal highlight. So keep a check, an eye out for your Instagram and Facebook for the stories that will allow you to vote on which marine mammal will be next. Don't know who we're going to put up there, but I think we're going seal versus dolphin lately. Isn't that what we're?
I believe so. I believe that's kind of where we're at right now. So it should be good.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see who wins out. We always enjoy doing this for you guys. And so also remember, if you have any other topics or other things you want to us to talk about, please let us know. I think we are going to be doing that a bit more this year, balancing that with some journal reviews. But really, we wanted to talk about important things that are happening now that will be important to discuss. So with that, don't forget, you can also check out our website. We got cool merch, and you can always donate, because we are a small nonprofit, and all the money that we raise goes back to our research and to our educational initiatives like this to bring you this podcast and the other educational things that we have for you on our YouTube and social media channels. So with that, we will sign off and we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
This was brought to you by Pacific Mammal Research, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Check out our website, www.pacmam.org, that's P-A-C-M-A-M, to learn more about us, our research, and the educational opportunities that we provide. Also, help us continue providing fun and educational content like this by donating today. Your help is how we can continue to do our work and share it with you. Thanks.